This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start the day with reparations. Fresh off our conversation yesterday about Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy, speaking truth to power, we consider the move by the Boston City Council to create a panel that will make specific recommendations to the city on reparations. The council voted unanimously in December to form a task force. Mayor Michelle Wu supports it, but it is a sticky subject. In April 2021, UMass Amherst and WCVB Channel 5 conducted a national poll and found that nearly half of those asked definitely didn't believe descendants of those enslaved in the U.S. should receive payments. So what would it take to move the needle on reparations, and where are we in the process right now here in Boston? Here to help us dig in on that, president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP, Tanisha Sullivan. Tanisha, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Tiziana.
And Tanisha, as I understand it, by ordinance, the NAACP will have a, you name it, a role, a slot, a place on this panel. Is that correct?
Well, no, we do not have, we specifically did not design this task force to have designated seats. Mayor Wu will appoint at least five people to the task force, which will ultimately steer the work. Certainly, given that the NAACP Boston branch worked with our city council starting in 2020 to bring forward this work, we certainly will be making some recommendations about folks who we believe, experts who we believe would be well suited to serve, though.
So this isn't the first time that the concept of reparations have come up with the city council, Tanisha, but it does feel like this task force is a pretty significant new step. So A, does it feel like that to you? Are we in a different moment? And do you feel like what we do have about design, structure, et cetera, is the right way to approach the task?
This is a major step forward. I certainly want to give acknowledgement to former, the late state Senator Bill Owens for really introducing the conversation around reparations to us here in Massachusetts, really back in the 80s. It has been a long road to get to this point, but it is certainly the establishment of this task force is a giant step forward. Here in Boston, what we've been very intentional about is ensuring that our process as it relates to this work is intentional about all of Boston having the opportunity to better understand the history of enslavement in this country, and also what happened here in Boston. You know, from certainly chattel slavery or the ownership of slaves, to the policies and practices here in the city of Boston, to quite frankly, how slavery was empowered through financing. It is our hope that as a city, we'll be able to learn together about that history, quite frankly, before we even get into a conversation about what reparations or repair may or may not look like.
So a couple places I want to go with that, Tanisha, and I'm glad you brought up this idea of history and what happened here in Boston. There are more than reparations in this scope of work. Reconciliation is an important concept as well. And I found myself thinking about this because it seems like the racial reconciliation needs here are, I wouldn't say actually much more recent, but also recent. I'm thinking, for example, of busing in the 1970s. We still see tension over Boston public schools and access to opportunity today. So how to situate work that looks at the legacy of slavery, what happened then, but mm-hmm. in the context of racial harms that are recent in our Boston history?
That's right. I mean, and this is an important piece. You know, so often in the conversation about reparations, people go immediately to the end of the story, or, you know, the question about, well, you know, what's the dollar figure that can compensate for this harm? Quite frankly, there is no dollar figure that can compensate for the harm that is caused, that was caused, that is caused by the enslavement of people. But that's not where we begin. And from an NAACP standpoint, we have been very intentional about trying to resist or helping our communities resist going to that point first. We really believe it's important for us to start with the history. Let's learn this together. You know, there are a lot of stories out there, there are myths out there, and then there's fact out there. Let's start together learning about what happened here in Boston, in the greater Boston area, relative to chattel slavery. What was, in fact, our role, both the good and the bad? Because we know this is a city where there was strong, where there was a strong abolitionist movement. So we want to lift that up too. But what specifically was our role? And then let's talk about what we've done over the past few decades to help address the harms, the impact of enslavement. Let's talk about what we've done here in the city of Boston to help address the impact of systemic racism. And then let's talk about the work that still needs to be done.
So
that's what we get to the conversation about reparations.
So a lot of richness there. One thread I'll pick up on, and we're speaking with Tanisha Sullivan, who's the president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP, about the move by the city of Boston, the Boston City Council, to put together a task force to consider and make recommendations about reconciliation and reparations for the city. You made a reference to the greater Boston area and our history, Tanisha, also on my mind, because we have, for example, port cities and towns. You have the history of Salem. You have the history of New Bedford. But this is authorized and powered by the Boston City Council. And how does it work when one city, with certainly, as you've just noted, a lot of its own history, moves forward in a context that really is, Tanisha, in terms of systemic racism, as well as our collective history around slavery and abolition, regional in its nature?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, again, I think it's important for us to have this conversation in a historical context, because what we know today is Boston was not, you know, the boundaries of Boston was not, you know, we're not the boundaries of Boston 200 years ago. And so having an understanding that the city, the geography of the city we know today was not the geography of the city that was. But the other piece of this, Tiziana, I think is to really focus, for us to really focus on this as an opportunity for, again, shared learning and understanding. I know that there is a national debate going on this issue. I also am well aware that this can be a polarizing issue, right? But I'm also a deep believer that here in Boston, we have the capacity to do this work and to do it in a way that really does help more of us better understand our collective history. And I am very committed to helping ensure that as best as we possibly can, this is a process that, although will likely be painful and hard, is one that in the end can help bring us just a little bit closer together so that we can really do the work of inclusion, so that we can really do the work necessary to ensure that all people within the city of Boston have the opportunity to benefit from all that the city has to offer.
So let's stay with the city for a minute. Tanisha, we talk with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu every month, and last month, her December appearance with us happened to be after the vote by the Boston City Council, which was a unanimous vote. I asked her at the time, you know, was she going to support the ordinance? She said she did. And she said to us, I'm going to play a little sound for you here in a second, that she thought Boston, kind of as a foundational city of the nation, actually had a unique responsibility to lead on the issue, especially with the city's 400th anniversary in sight in 2030 and the nation's 250th anniversary in sight in 2026. Here she is.
We need to be putting in the work to do that deep digging and reflection and look back of what the city of Boston's formal role was, the many ways in which we were involved in the practice of enslavement benefited from and what the current impacts continue to be resulting from that.
There are NAACP chapters all over the country. Are you hearing from other parts of the country? Do they see Boston with our sort of unique place in American history as a leader in this?
I think there's an understanding that that we all have a responsibility to step up and lead when it comes to really helping our communities better understand the history of enslavement in this country and the lingering impacts of it today. That said, you know, to the mayor's point, I do believe that each city has, you know, something to offer to in this country, has something to offer to this conversation. We did not every city across the country, not every community across the country had the same relationship with chattel slavery, right? And so when we think about Boston, for example, you know, one of the things that I'm looking forward to personally, just learning a little bit more about is, you know, our role as an enabling city. When we think about the institution of slavery, right? Slavery was sustained not only by those who directly owned owned slaves or directly by those who directly was not only sustained by those who were engaged in the practice of owning, so-called owning people, but it was also allowed to sustain and thrive, quite frankly, by those who enabled it. You know, there's financing that was involved in this practice.
Purchasing of goods and services that were made by industries that used enslaved labor, for example.
That used enslaved labor. And so I'm interested to better understand, because of course we've heard the stories about the role that our financial institutions played in the institution of slavery. I want to better understand that personally. And so I look forward, you know, as much as anybody else, as being a part of this learning process. And again, I want to underscore this. Yes, it is going to be hard. Yes, there are going to be aspects of this process that, you know, some of us might want to kind of turn a blind eye to. But I do believe it's important work for us to do. I do believe that there's value in it. Again, kind of learning this history and that we're going to be able to do it together.
Tanisha, I'm sorry, we have limited time and there are a couple other things I want to make sure to ask you. So bear with me because I'm going to move us to today for a minute. We talked a little bit about, you know, reparations is at the end. There's reconciliation and learning to do in the meantime. I want to put the embrace, the new monument unveiled on Friday, in this context. We talked with Reverends Willie Bodrick II and Mariama White Hammond about it yesterday on the show, and I'm sure you're aware there's a good deal of criticism about the choice of the symbols in this monument, the forearms of Dr. King and Coretta Scott King hugging. Every city's on a journey, and there's a distance from, say, busing to the summer of 2020 after George Floyd's murder here to the monument, to this panel. Where do you situate the embrace in our journey, and what is your thought about the criticism of Hank Willis Thomas's design?
So one of the things that I deeply appreciate about the embrace, the process bringing us to the to the monument, to the tribute, is that there was a very intentional public process that began several years ago. And folks from across the city of Boston had the opportunity, residents across the city of Boston had the opportunity to weigh in on how we here in Boston wanted to honor and lift up the Kings. And the embrace is the piece that was selected. I think it's important to note that you know, and acknowledge that this is, you know, it's different than what we've seen other cities and other communities do to lift up the Kings. And, you know, I think it's important for us here in Boston to be open to what people have to say and use it as an opportunity, again, to learn. in the early stages of this project, one of the things that we talked a lot about as a community was that our hope that this monument would open up conversation and dialogue. And indeed, it has. And so I'm hopeful that we will lean into it, that we will shirk the kind of the pull to be defensive about it, but really lean into it, be open to the conversation, and hope that it can inspire more creativity, that it can inspire more hope for people, not just here in Boston, but across the country.
Last question for you, Tanisha Sullivan. Just briefly, what's the most important concrete next step here?
Well, I think a few things. One, specifically on the topic of reparations here in the city of Boston, I think it's important for us to, and for the mayor to get the composition of the task force right. These are the folks who will help to steer this process. They will not be the decision makers, but they'll be steering this process. So making sure that we've got the right folks sitting around that table who understand the importance of this work and who are committed to us doing it in a way that is healthy and helps to unite and not further divide. And specifically as it relates to the embrace, the next step has to be the work. Look, the Kings were not about monuments and statues. They were about the work of alleviating poverty, about creating a more inclusive community and society. And so I look forward to the work of Embrace Boston really beginning now in helping to carry forward the work of the Kings so that we can truly have the type of community live in the beloved community that King spoke of.
Tanisha Sullivan, president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's continue now with the MBTA, where a state agency tasked with overseeing safety investigations at the T is falling short. A new WBUR investigation shows that the Department of Public Utilities has continually allowed the T to miss deadlines for submitting reports related to safety investigations. Of the 129 rail-related investigations from 2021 through last October, 80% were filled past their deadlines. WBUR's senior investigative reporter Beth Healy has been reporting on these missed deadlines, joins us now to talk about what it could mean for the wider system. It's from the newsroom. Beth is here. Hey there, Beth.
Hey, good morning.
So I want you to take us back, remind us a little bit. I'm sure people are like, no, don't do this, but remind us of the history of the state of safety on the T. How many incidents are we talking about? What were some of the big ones from 21, 22?
Absolutely. So there were, as you mentioned, 129 that we looked at from the records we got. But the DPU tells us that they investigated 104 incidents just last year at the T. And essentially what's going on here is collisions, derailments, a fire on a battery on an orange line, near misses. I think people recall the various headlines of these things happening. And the DPU, while it is meant to be in charge, most people probably know, of electricity and gas and water, also is charged with overseeing safety at the T.
So, okay, what does it mean? Like, okay, backtrack. Everybody's been in school. Everybody's had a teacher that lets you submit your homework late and another teacher that says, nope, if you don't get it in on time, you don't get it in, you get a failing grade. What does it mean in your findings that the DPU allowed the MBTA to submit 80% of its reports, not just late, but as I understand it, Beth, significantly late? Yes, a lot of the time.
Right. So there's a 60-day deadline for the T to turn in its initial investigative report. And as we all know, if there's nobody saying that, hey, you really need to turn that in, these things slide. The T's allowed to ask for extensions, but what we found out is that they're allowed to ask for endless extensions. And if they don't turn the report in on time, then that means it's a delay for the DPU to do its review of the investigations. And in turn, that means that the safety fixes, the corrective action plans, those are getting delayed as well. And you're right, not just 60 days, some of them were months late.
And what have you heard when you've talked to people about what's problematic with this?
Right. So we brought this to the Federal Transit Administration, to Joe DiLorenzo, who's the federal safety chief who oversaw the big report that came out last summer in August that you remember. And we asked him, does lateness really matter?
In their role as regulator, they need to make sure that they get the reports and they get them on time and they're not continually extending those things.
And is there teeth, Beth? So let's say the DPU, Department of Public Utilities, was enforcing it and saying to the MBTA, every time there is one of these safety issues, you will get this in within 60 days. We will then promptly complete our review of your report. And then we will say you need to do this, 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 and this. When we get to that step, if we were there and that we're working well, do we know how well the DPU, especially with its staffing, its budget, could enforce such, you need to do this, 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 and this is?
Right. It's a big problem. The DPU is deeply understaffed. The FTA and some of the reports have said they have concerns about their independence from the T. It used to be that people might kind of leave the T and make their way over to the DPU's transit staff. There were only 6 people on the transit over safety staff at the DPU as of last September. They told Senator Warren in October that they were trying to increase that to 18. That's not very many people to oversee all of those.
Yeah, you said 129 or 104 incidents in a single year.
Exactly. So, and at the top of the DPU, the big problem is that the years keep going by and there's no one with transit experience at the top of the DPU.
So the effectiveness, the ability to read between the lines, the ability to know what kinds of solutions might be the right ones, there's a knowledge and a wisdom there that's lacking, Beth.
Right. You need an independent review of the T's incidents by another body in order to keep it safe.
Okay. So Beth Healy, hang tight. I'm going to bring another voice in here. I'm going to turn to Jim Aloisi now, who's the former Secretary of Transportation for the Commonwealth, sits on the board of Transit Matters, has talked with us a number of times about the T over the last couple of years. Welcome back, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
So if I were to imagine, which I did, Jim, when I first saw this article, what you would say about the data, I think you would say you are not surprised. Is that right?
Not at all. I mean, the idea that the DPU has any kind of significant oversight role here certainly came as a surprise to many people, including myself, who was Secretary of Transportation a decade ago. I mean, it's been an agency that's been largely unheard from and largely, obviously, ineffective in terms of its role as the safety oversight agency of the Commonwealth. So, you know, I think the new governor, Governor Healy, has said she's going to appoint a safety chief. I assume she's also going to look carefully at the governance structure, which Beth mentioned, which is having an oversight agency and the agency that it's overseeing both report to the same state elected official. Maybe something that needs to be changed or tweaked or modified going forward. But look, we're talking about something really, I think, pretty simple and straightforward, right? And what should an oversight agency do? You know, it should establish reasonable protocols. It should require that the agency that it's overseeing adhere to those reasonable protocols. It should carefully document those activities. It should develop reasonable corrective action plans, and it should be transparent with the government and the media and the public about what is going on.
So, right? Jim, I want to ask you a couple of follow-up questions on that. And first, yeah. I'm just gonna go back and do this facetious or serious question. When you said it was news to you as the Secretary of Transportation for the Commonwealth, was the DPU so far out of the picture that it actually was news to you that they had this oversight responsibility when you were in the role?
Yes.
Okay, so not facetious there. So then my next question is, was it a problem from the get-go? Should a public utilities organ, do we have a structural problem here where a public utilities organization never should have been the one responsible for oversight of a transit system in the first place, Jim?
I think that's the answer. And it seems to me that this decision, I don't know how the decision was made or by whom, but it seems to me that it had to be a decision made as a default, right? Well, the DPU sets rates and governs, you know, the Peter Pan bus and Greyhound bus, they do that. So, oh, buses, so we'll make them the T oversight agency. It makes no sense. You might build from the ground up a separate entity in the Commonwealth. Maybe it's a subset of the Department of Public Safety, right? where you bring in the capacity, and not just the capacity, but the expertise and the capability to do the job, right? And so I think that's important, number one. I think number two, you need to look at whether the T governance structure still is the right one, or whether we need to have more of a municipal power structure at the T that's shared with the state government, so that the T does not become solely a state entity as it's been for decades.
Right? So a couple things there to understand. So first, this idea, and Beth Healy touched on this to our senior investigative reporter, this idea that it's got to be a separate entity, sounds like you concur that's a key piece to making sure the oversight has teeth. Is that right?
I do. And I want to have a note of caution here, as we're obviously time limited on the radio. We're seeing exactly what's about to happen in Massachusetts. We're seeing it unfold in real time in Washington, D.C., where there's also a Federal Transit Administration safety inspection review of their transit system. And the red flag that was recently brought to light in an article by the Washington Post is that if an oversight agency then doesn't understand its proper role, right? This is the fear I have, is that we'll re-engineer from the DPU, but we have to do it right. Because if the oversight agency thinks it's going to micromanage the T, that is also a danger. We need an oversight agency that can be an effective partner with the MBTA, not an effective micromanager, but an effective partner in working through important safety protocols and responsiveness and transparency.
So then right now we have an interim MBTA general manager, Jeff Gonneville, and Governor Healy has taken on a executive search firm to find a new GM. Before I turn back to Beth Healy, Jim, so we've been talking about an oversight agency that's separate, but clarity of vision, cooperation, and urgency inside the MBTA to get those reports in on time, to be responsive to the safety requirements by an oversight committee, et cetera, also important. What do you want to see from that perspective in a strong GM candidate?
Well, I think a strong GM candidate obviously has to be deeply rooted in transit operations. By the way, Jeff Gonneville as the acting general manager is a really first-rate selection. He could be a candidate for the job. He might well be a candidate for the job, and that wouldn't be a bad thing.
And he served as the deputy general manager since 2017, I understand.
Yeah, I mean, he has a solid history in the MBTA, and I think would bring a different perspective than prior leadership. But whoever is going to be the GM is going to have the major, major task of doing two things. That person is going to have to improve employee morale, and that person is going to have to improve rider confidence. And both of those things are going to take time. I think that we need to be able to you know, the expression, walk and chew gum at the same time. We need to have a safe T that also provides high quality service delivery. We cannot sacrifice subway frequencies and service delivery on the altar of safety. We need to do both. And I think that's the essential challenge of the next general manager of the T and the Healy administration, is to be able to show that we can provide both, right? And so the safest transit system is a system where nothing moves. Well, we can't have that. We need to have a safe system.
Yeah, we've had that. We don't want that.
Well, but right? So we need a system that works well. 400 people in 2021, over 400 people in 2021 died in automobile accidents and crashes on roads in Massachusetts. We don't say the road system is unsafe, right? So I think we need to bring some perspective to this MBTA safety conversation. And as a T rider myself, a frequent rider, I think we need to have a safe T that also has 7-minute subway frequencies and the kind of service delivery that riders need in order to get to the destinations we know that they want to reach.
All right. Jim Aloisi is former Secretary of Transportation for the Commonwealth and a frequent rider, if you will, with us here on Radio Boston about the T. Jim, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Tatiana.
Now, turning back to WBUR senior investigative reporter Beth Healy, who's still with me here in Studio 2. So, you know, I know you've talked to Jim before, but what's your reaction to what you just heard?
I think Jim makes good points, and we did, of course, talk to him for the story. You know, the thing you got to ask yourself is, would a new agency in Massachusetts, what would it cost? How long would it take? We've got a crisis at the T that needs to be fixed immediately. So I don't think anyone's saying that a new agency is a panacea. On the other hand, when you look at the DPU and you say, why is it taking so long to fix it? Why is it taking so long to get transit experience there? So it's a real quandary for the governor and the legislature.
So what have the T and the DPU said to you in response to your story work?
So neither one wanted to sit down for an interview. We did get responses from the DPU in the form of kind of emails back and forth with a spokesperson, not the same as getting to sit down with someone. You know, the T says that they have had shortages as well, and you know, bus from everything from bus drivers to their own investigative group. And the DPU says that they are allegedly working hard to staff up and get these additional employees that Senator Warren is bugging them to hurry up and get it done, too.
So, Beth, this is what you do, right? You dive into public records. It's something you're quite talented at. You look for what the data is going to tell you. When you figured out what the data was telling you in this case, was it a surprise or is it what you expected?
Well, we went after records right after that August report that came out by the FTA and said, let's find out what the DPU actually does. It turned out they had thousands of records. So we did learn that they do stuff, right? They go and they look at the tracks. They have announced and unannounced visits. They show up within a couple hours after an accident. But what this particular thing showed us, this investigation tracker, this spreadsheet with this column of red of all of the late reports, it just kind of came through as a very kind of, you know, fact-oriented data point that showed, okay, all these reports are coming in late. The DPU can't seem to force the T to turn them in on time. It gives you this window into a critical problem as far as submitting reports and following up.
And so last question, just briefly, what's something you're going to follow up on or watch next?
We're waiting to see who the governor appoints as a new safety chief. That person's going to review the T and make recommendations about the DPU and whether it should be doing oversight. Plus, a lot of lawmakers are looking at whether the DPU should continue in this role.
All right, WBUR senior investigation reporter Beth Healy. Beth, thank you.
Thanks, Tiziana.
We are back with our regular funny stuff segment where we talk with local comedians about the humorous side of life in Massachusetts. It's our first conversation of 2023. So here to talk about making it, quote unquote, and I'm going to put it like 52 quote unquotes around that, our local comedians Bethany Van Delft and Ken Reed. Bethany, welcome back.
Hi. Thanks for having us back.
Yep. And Ken, Happy New Year. Welcome back to you.
Happy New Year to you. Thank you.
All right. So I want to set this up. We were preparing to talk to you, and the Boston Globe puts out an article earlier this month by Nick Zano about Boston comics creating their own specials. So one of the things we thought about is we'd be interested in your take. And I want to give a little history here. It's 2013, and Aziz Ansari's comedy special, Buried Alive, debuts on Netflix. Here's a little sound.
And now everyone has video cameras on their phones and everything, so you get videos of the babies. Every single video I've gotten is exactly the same, though. Kid shows up on the screen. End of clip. That's the amazing footage they needed to share with everyone. I'm Brian's first steps.
Okay, so I noticed he's been complicated since then, but sure. Our point here is that it was the only special produced by Netflix that year. Now, you fast forward 9 years, 2022, Netflix produces 65 comedy specials. So, with that kind of in mind, what does it mean, Ken, to make it if you're a Boston comedian?
It's sort of, it's different for everybody. Like my making it is just doing good stuff and being able to do good stuff and having people find it. But even that model of Netflix, those 65 specials, Netflix didn't produce any of them. They bought them already made. So it's a different model where there's no gatekeepers anymore to sort of say, hey, you're good. Here's some money. We'll produce something for you. It's now, hey, do you have something we can buy that's already made or already established? And there's no – it used to be the special was sort of the end game, right? And now for most people, it's a promotional tool. So a very successful comedian who I won't mention, when I put out my second album, said, the reason you put out an album is to have something to promote. which sounds very cynical, but is also kind of true. Like, that's how you go do press and talk to people about what you're doing if you have something to talk about. So a special is kind of that now, and it allows you to do more live work if you can.
So almost like, Bethany, that adage that it used to be that musicians made their money on their songs. And now they make songs so that they can tour because they make their money on live shows.
There's that for sure. But I also think it's a way for people to see you, you know. So not just something to promote, but yeah, definitely something to promote. But, you know, if you have a special or you have like lots of clips that perform really well, then maybe, you know, maybe Kimmel notices you, you get your late night spot. And then from the late night spot, maybe, you know, ABC notices you and you get, you know, get an all around deal. Because the way those things used to happen, it doesn't happen that way anymore. There's so many avenues to put your work out that I think now a special is just another way to put your work out, kind of.
Yeah.
Not, and I'm not disparaging anybody or saying that it's not valuable. I do think it is very valuable, but there's just it's a different way of doing it now.
Okay, a lot of threads I want to pick up on there. But before I do, I asked Ken, Bethany, what making it means to him. So let me ask you, what is making it as a Boston comedian mean to you?
Well, first it would be that I'm not always qualified as a Boston comedian. It would be that, you know, I do good work and people like the work. And so it's known and I get to make a living making things that I personally like. I mean, making it to me is it's very internal and personal. And I've said for a long time now, I will feel like I made it when I think that I'm funny, like I'm hilariously funny, you know. I think for me personally, that would feel like making it. But making it would be to make a living, and you know, give my kids the things they need and have a comfortable life. That would be making it. But there's no thing that would make me feel that way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like being here on Radio Boston, I kind of feel like I made it as a Boston comedian.
Woot woot.
If that's okay. But so I guess that's how I think of it is. What do I want to put out there? And where can I put it out there? And how can we get people to see it and enjoy it? Or
I will say the jackets you guys gave us with Boston Comedian embroidered on the back the first time we did the show does help feel, you know.
Now every chef and everyone else, wait a minute. Okay, so I'm going to play a little sound here. This is Orlando Baxter, grew up in Worcester, taught at Worcester High, filmed a stand-up special there. It's called Live from South High. He posted it 8 months ago. It has 32,000 views right now. Here it is.
They would never say, oh, he got a cross eye. They would say, he got a lazy eye. Look at him. A lazy eye, which is rude, in my opinion. It's not like my eye had an option. It's not like my eye woke up one morning and was like, man, forget this job.
So, Ken, I'll turn back to you. What strikes me about that cut and the fact that he went to his high school, right, is this sense that making it or not making it, special crashes big or it doesn't. This is deeply personal work, and you want to pay honor to and, I always pronounce this word wrong, give homage to the things that influenced you. Can you do that here in Boston? Is it a heavy lift? And does it cheapen it in any way to then have your TikTok videos and the Instagram and one out on Twitter and I'm trying to get Kimmel, as Bethany said, to pay attention to it? Talk about that.
I think now more than ever, it doesn't cheapen it in a lot of ways because the great thing is everyone can do a special and have the same distribution as anyone else. The bad thing is that's also true because a lot of people probably shouldn't. But you have the power. The entry level of being able to produce a professional looking and sounding special is within reach of just about everybody. And you can distribute it to everybody. So even something like Kimmel or like James Corden gets less than 100,000 viewers.
Okay.
So if someone, you know, he's got Orlando has 32,000 views on that in 8 months, like that's, and they're engaged and have seeked it out. They're not like passively watching it. So there's that as well. you can be in charge of how you want your stuff to be presented. So in that case, he did a special, but it's tied to, he taught at that school. A lot of his materials mm-hmm. about that school. So it's more than just let's throw a camera up and show people doing a special. I always look at stand-up comedy as sort of a live exclusive experience in that eating in a restaurant is different from watching Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives about a restaurant. They're both have their own entertainment value, but just watching it isn't the same as experiencing it. So in order to make it interesting, you need to have those more personal things or those more unique things, because otherwise, why are we watching you specifically? What about you makes it interesting?
Okay, so a couple things there. First, just for listeners, James Corden, nighttime TV host, known for doing those videos where he rides in a car and lip sync a song with somebody like, you know, what's her name?
Adele.
I Want to Swing from the Chandelier, what's her, Sia, or yep. Adele, Paul McCartney. The second thing, and you both chuckled, so I'm going to take Ken's line. I'm going to turn it to you, Bethany. Ken said, maybe some people shouldn't. That wasn't quite the line. But the idea that not everybody should have a special. And yet, if we're talking about what makes you funny and what's funny to you, why shouldn't everybody be able to film at their high school auditorium and put a special out if they want to?
I think everybody, if they want to, they should do it. You know, me and Ken are different there.
Yeah.
I'm like, go
Bethany
on and do it.
No.
Yeah. Go on and do it if you want to do it. I guess what we're talking about is what makes it good.
Oh, is that it, Ken?
Orlando's specials. Phenomenal. Well, Orlando's an amazing comedian,
right.
Like an original, amazing, heartfelt comedian. When you hear his set or his just his jokes, you know that these are personal and they're coming from a place of deep thought and super funny. And for him to go back to the place where this kind of all began for him is just, it's so creative, it's so cool, and it really does what Orlando does really great, which is bring you into his life and into his thoughts in out like externally.
Right. Some people don't have the perspective of when they should do a special, because there are things that we've done on stage that 2-3 years later you're like, oh, that was terrible. So, but at the time you're like, this is great. So the fact that there are some gatekeepers to say, you're ready, do a special, was sort of helpful.
Okay, so that's a perfect chance then to bring up for our listeners and for their joy, you each gave us some specials that you think are very funny. And Ken, you just set up the Johnny Vegas special, the one Ready for Ice Cream, so well, which I watched yesterday and laughed my head off at, because he pokes fun specifically at himself for reaching a point where he doesn't recognize he's not funny
right.
anymore. Okay, so here's a little bit of sound from the beginning.
Please welcome Johnny Vegas.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd love to say something funny happened on the way over here tonight, but, you know, having a chauffeur-driven car really does cut down on awkward coincidences.
Johnny Vegas has declined as a result of, quite simply, fame.
And that opening monologue is so painful. By the yes. time he's done, the theater's like empty, but he's like, yeah, that was great.
Right. I'm a theater comic.
So why did you find that special so funny? By the way, he's taken sort of stripped down, taken back. We have a cut of him. I don't think we'll use it, but eating baby food
right. he's
again.
He's humiliated to make himself funny again. He's gotten too comfortable is the yeah. sort of idea. So his management hires someone to humiliate him. It's a funny you know, structure to, and then the stand-up shows are real shows. So the stand-up shows you see are him doing shows in small theaters in Edinburgh, doing and sort of starting over again with this very funny conceit around it that's unique to watching that special. You wouldn't get that live, and it adds this story of what it's like, which is so amazing. And I've never seen anyone else do anything like that.
It's really gutsy. He makes himself look terrible.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah. there is a truth-telling to
yeah.
it.
Yeah, and at the end, it's sort of triumphant. And when the final set he does on that is on the special, you feel really great. You're like, he did it! Like, it's kind of this whole arc, you know?
All right, so Bethany, I will admit, when I heard what you picked, I'm like, really? But let's bear with it, because we're going to play a good amount of sound on this. This is Adam Sandler. This is Netflix. It's called 100% Fresh.
The pilot had a heart attack. The co-pilot can't be found.
And I'll say, I was like, seriously, he's singing again? But listen.
Oh, the plane going down. We need a hero, someone to save us. We need a hero to land the plane. We need a hero who's gonna do it. We need a hero to save the day.
A little bit more.
So I jump to my feet and I volunteer. The people on the plane all start to cheer. I get a high five from my baby and a hickey from a flight attendant.
All right, so you can
understand. You're laughing.
I was, right? And this feels like rehabilitation for someone who was literally Johnny Vegas,
yeah,
like in real life, Bethany.
Perhaps, yeah. I mean, so I'm of the age where what he was doing, what Adam Sandler was doing originally on Saturday Night Live was super funny,
yeah,
to me.
Yeah.
I was at that right age where that was just hilarious.
It was, yep, different,
yeah,
though, too.
It was super different. He wasn't trying to say anything, you know, intelligent or change. He just was goofy. The pencil hand man, the Halloween costume pencil hand man, I was the right age for that to be the funniest thing in the world. And so I was pencil hand man many, many Halloweens. This special I really like because after getting all of his movie roles and producing and becoming a big, big, huge, very wealthy celebrity, he went back to what he loves the most, which is singing really silly songs. And I've always loved that he has the voice of a slightly above average rock singer, but he chose to do comedy. So I've always loved that about him. But he brought it back to what he loves best, which is doing silly songs and silly bits. And what I especially love about this special is, as a comedian, we know how much work it takes to get that hour and how many times you have to run a joke or 15 minutes or a 20 minutes or an hour to get to the place where you feel that it's polished enough and you feel confident enough to make a special. And he shows us kind of how many times you have to do that with all the different clips. I don't know if you haven't seen it, the special is clips of different venues that he performed this hour at, and it's all edited together. And it really gives the sense of, wow, this isn't just somebody goes up and does an hour, even somebody as famous and wealthy as Adam Sandler. He worked really hard to get that hour just like we all did.
And he didn't have to.
He could have put anything out.
He wanted to.
Yeah.
All right, so here's what I've learned from today, right? And every time I talk to the two of you, I learn something that I literally wasn't thinking about at all when we started the conversation.
You're welcome, and I'm sorry.
Yes, that's exactly right. So as we wrap here, what I feel like I've learned is you have to be in a certain place. Yeah, you can make your own special now, but you only should when you've been on a personal journey where you've done the work, you're self-aware, and you're ready to be funny.
Sure.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's fair.
All right. All right.
Simplest,
yeah, easy. There
world.
You go. Nothing else to it. All right. Ken Reed is a Boston comedian, host of the TV Guidance Counselor podcast, and Bethany Van Delft is Boston comedian and a regular host for the Moth Story Slams and Grand Slams. Great to have you back. Happy New Year. We will do this again.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank
Happy
you
New
for
Year.
Having us back.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, and Sydney Bowles, with Bart Tachi and Andrea Perdomo Hernandez. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Titus Faladun is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.